Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. It's May 7, 2012, and this is episode 334. Andrew S. Gibson is a technical editor for EOS magazine and Craft and Vision author, as well as an author of his own ebooks. We have a number of great topics to talk about, so I'm really looking forward to this chat. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Hello, Martin.
It's been a while since we started communicating. You were kind enough to do an interview on your blog when I released my Craft and Vision ebook. So thanks very much for that. And I've been really looking forward to this. It's not very often that I get a chance to speak to someone with a marginally similar accent to myself. So,
yes. What part of the UK are you from?
I'm originally from a small town called Long Eaton between Nottingham and Derby. You'll know Nottingham and Derby, I'm sure.
Oh, yes. I seem to have heard the name somewhere, but I've probably never been there.
Yeah. Everyone in that town used to call it a pimple on the M1.
Maybe that's where I know it from. Then driving along the M1, I've probably seen the signs to it.
Yeah. It's literally, I'm not sure if this is something that they do on purpose or if this is like a general convention, but if you go to England on Google Maps and you zoom in, the place where it says England, always the next next letters to where it says England is Long Eaton.
So you're right in the middle somewhere.
I imagine it's smack in the middle. If you drew across England. but it's not a bad little town. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, your photography and your writing.
Well, I'm a freelance writer at the moment. I've been freelancing for about a year and a half, I think. Mm. And before that, I spent a couple of years working for EOS magazine as a technical writer and then technical editor of the magazine. And that is really where my writing career started. Before that, I had a different job. I was actually working on cruise ships for a few years, and I decided to have a career change, and that's what I decided on.
That's pretty cool. So the writing part, what got you started in actual writing? You know, it's obviously photography. I can imagine on a cruise ship, you've got a lot of great photo opportunities.
Yes, I mean, I wasn't working as a photographer on a cruise ship. I was actually, they have internet cafes, and I was in charge of the internet cafe on there. But, you know, you're right, you do get to travel to a lot of places. Mm. But the only thing is that cruise ships tend to put in the morning and leave in the late afternoon. So you do tend to miss the best time of the day for taking photos, which is a little bit frustrating. But, you know, I did go to a lot of places, which was really good. And also I did quite a bit of traveling in between contracts as well. So that was, that was good as well. But what I wanted to do really, my aim was to do something creative. I wasn't really quite sure what, but working on the cruise ship isn't very creative, so it doesn't fulfill that side of my personality. And I was looking at different things, and I was always interested in photography when I was younger. I actually studied photography at university, and I thought, well, I'd like to get into photography, but not, as a photographer, but something related to photography. And, when I was younger, I always liked writing, although fiction, not non-fiction. And I decided that, being a writer, writing about photography could be something that would really suit me. And, I started a blog. I started, writing a couple of articles, and I was quite pleased with how my first couple of articles came out. And, I just started from there.
Wow, that's pretty cool. So the EOS magazine gig, was it your blog that went on to the EOS magazine work that you did?
Well, I'd done a bit of freelance work for them before they decided that they needed to employ someone full time and advertised it, and there was a little bit of luck in getting that job, really. I have to admit, because when you're starting off Yeah, I've actually been for a few different interviews with UK photography magazines. And when you're starting off, it seems to be quite hard to get a job because there's a lot of other, well-qualified people applying for those same jobs. And, you know, usually there's only one job. It's not like a job at a supermarket where they're looking to fulfill a number of positions. Mm. You know, there's one job and, you know, you either get it or you don't. But what happened with EOS magazine is that I'd written a few articles for them previously. Mm. It's not available on the newsstand in the UK, so it probably doesn't have the high profile as some of the other magazines. So maybe they didn't get the same level of applicants. But also, they required the applicant to actually move to a remote village in Oxfordshire, which is where they are based. And that knocked quite a few, I think, applicants out from what I understood afterwards. They had quite a few applicants that wanted to, were interested, but asking if they could do it on a freelance basis, working from home. And that's not what they wanted. They wanted someone working in the office. But I think with, jobs like that, if you want one, you have to just keep applying when they come up until, things fall into place and you turn out to be the candidate they choose.
Got you. Yeah. So at that time you moved to Oxford then.
Yes.
Where are you originally from in the UK?
I was born in Kent, but I grew up in Australia.
I see.
I lived there for 10 years when I was growing up, and then my family moved back to the UK, and they now live in Norfolk.
I see. So you get about a bit. I mean, you're currently in New Zealand, right?
That's right. Yes.
And you were telling me that you'd spent like 6 months in Shanghai. Is this all as photography projects, personal projects, to build material for your books and things like that?
Well, that's part of it. Part of the attraction of coming to New Zealand is that there are a lot of beautiful places and landscapes here, and it's a good place to take photos. I mean, the main reason we chose New Zealand is because my girlfriend is from here.
I see.
And so that's the main reason that we came here. I mean, if it wasn't for her, I probably wouldn't have come here, not with a view to moving here permanently. But my girlfriend was born in Shanghai, and that's part of the reason that we went to Shanghai. I'd always wanted to go there since we met, and we had an opportunity to go. She wanted to leave her job last year, but it wasn't working out too well, and so we said, why not go to Shanghai for 6 months? Having kind of a portable job as such, because I'm freelance and can work from anywhere, I can do. So yes, that's one thing I want to try and take advantage of while I'm set up to work this way.
Got you. So, again, I mean, obviously, I live in Tokyo. It's another eastern country compared to the West, of course. But
yes,
I find that there are, when you go to a country that is totally different culture. I mean, I've lived here for 21 years now, and so to me, this is actually more home than the UK now.
Yes, yes.
But when I first came, it was a huge eye-opener. Everything seemed different. So I imagine that when you moved to Shanghai or to New Zealand as well, it kind of opens your eyes with regards to photography. What are your opinions on that?
Yes, that's true. I mean, I'm helped by the fact that I've traveled a lot, so I'm used to kind of everywhere being different. I mean, when I was working on the cruise ships, I've traveled to over 70 countries.
Wow.
So, I've been to a lot of places, and I had been to China before, but not mainland China. I've been to Hong Kong and I've been to Taiwan. And also, I read some books before we went by people that had traveled to China. Yeah, my girlfriend is from there as well. So in many ways, I knew what to expect, although it was still a bit of a shock. I spent quite a bit of time in South America, and one thing that came across during my time there is how similar people are in South America, surprisingly similar, to people in the UK and Europe. And, probably shouldn't be that much of a surprise, really, because most of them are descended from Europeans. So there's a lot of similarities in the culture. But you go to China, and it's completely different. And yeah, this is a theme that has come across with foreigners that I've talked to that are there. I actually interviewed an interesting guy on my website that I met in China. He's a photographer and he's working as a commercial and editorial photographer in Shanghai and Beijing. And the way he got started was very interesting. I mean, the standard of his work is very high, but he was doing a job in Berlin, not as a photographer, something else which he didn't really like. He wanted a change. He had an EOS 10D, if you can believe that. It was a few years ago. And he just went to Shanghai with an EOS 10D. And one of his friends was working as a photographer in Shanghai. And he's now a professional commercial editorial photographer in Shanghai. But he said, which is amazing. He said in his interview, it's the same for him, the culture shock. He said he lived in quite a few places, China was something else.
Wow, that's it. That's pretty interesting. And the 10D, I mean, that was, although looking at it now, it's obviously, it's a little bit long in the tooth, and I'm sure there's not many people still using them, but it was an amazing camera. And I remember the change, because my first digital SLR was the D30, 3 megapixels. And
yes, I know it because we have one in the office. We have all the EOS cameras in the office, EOS magazine. So I have actually used it, yes.
Wow. So, I made the mistake of, I've been into photography since I was young, but I made the mistake of buying the D30 without really looking into how long it had been on the market and all of that. And I bought it just a couple of weeks before the D60 was announced for the same price and double the pixels. Yes. But then, so my jump to the 10D was from the D30. And I loved that camera. It was amazing. The images were much better than the D. The D30 was a good camera for what it was at the time, but the 10D really took it to a different level. So
I looked up once some of the old pre D30 cameras, the ones Canon made in conjunction with Kodak, and I found a couple of reviews of them which people had written at the time on their websites when they came out. Yeah. And these were expensive cameras. I think one of them was retailing for like $25,000 or something like that. Right. And it had I can't remember if it was 1 or 2 or 3 megapixels, but not many megapixels. Yeah. And it was surprising. They were raving about the quality they could get from these cameras. So I don't know whether that was the, because it was new and digital was so new, so anything seemed good, or whether, psychologically, if you pay so much money for something, then you're going to see the results as being quite good because, you equate it with being worth that amount of money. But it was, it's quite interesting how much technology we take for granted these days, the amazing tools that we have.
Yeah, I would imagine that there is definitely a certain amount of psychology behind that. If you pay a lot of money for something, you want to like it.
Yes.
But that's really interesting. They were huge as well. They were like really long, weren't they? They got a big unit at the bottom.
I've only ever seen pictures. Yeah, it's like an add-on unit at the bottom. So it's like the original SLR camera, but modified to take the unit, which connects to the bottom somehow.
Yeah, wacky stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, well that's brilliant. So you want to, let's move on and talk about your books a little. I know that you've just released a new one that we'll talk about shortly. But before we do that, obviously you've got how many do you have on Craft and Vision? Is it 4 or 5?
6.
6. Okay. I know I've got most of them. Excellent books. But you also publish ebooks just directly from yourself, and the first one of those is on Digital Photo Professional, right?
Yes. Well, actually, the first one was called Square, and it's about square format photography.
Oh, okay.
There's three on my own website. So there's Square, Understanding DPP, and Understanding Exposure. But Square was the first.
Okay. So Square, I'm sorry, I hadn't seen that. It's all about the square format.
That's right. Yes.
That's interesting.
It's just about kind of composition in the square format and how to crop your image to the square and different ideas for composition. Kind of photos you can take with it, that sort of thing.
Mm. Excellent. I like the square format myself. I sometimes crop to square. But and obviously shooting with a normal aspect, but with a mind for cropping it later. So that's an interesting subject for a book. I'll have to check that one out.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that no one seemed to be writing about much. And I'd done an article on EOS magazine on aspect ratios, and it made me realise that I used to have years ago a Bronica S2A, and I never used it much because I never really I liked it, but didn't really appreciate the qualities of the square format properly. And but back in those days before digital cameras, if you wanted to use take square photos, you had to have a square format camera. Pretty much, unless you wanted to crop in the darkroom. But now it's a bit like black and white. You don't have to use black and white film and build a black and white darkroom. You can just dabble in it. It's opened it up to a lot more people.
I'm sure. So your DPP book. It's no secret that I'm not a fan of DPP.
Yes, I noticed that. Yes.
But I've received a number of mails over the maybe more so over the last year or so from people that actually take offence to the fact that I don't like it. But it's and believe me, I want to like it. When Lightroom first came out, all I'd really used was DPP, and although Lightroom caught my attention from the beta, it took me a little bit of time to move because I was quite reliant on the picture styles, and I only finally moved to it was still during the beta, but I made the switch to Lightroom when I figured out that I could pretty much emulate what I was getting in DPP, which is kind of the Velvia look. I'm a big fan of the landscape picture style. Punchy greens, punchy reds, and nice blue skies. Yeah, very, very vivid colors. So when I figured out that I could actually emulate that in Lightroom by punching the saturation up a little bit, which I did on import, I was happy to move. But there were still a lot of things I know that DPP is good for. Although my personal workflow now it's all totally Lightroom. But tell us a little bit about your experiences with DPP and why you wrote a book on it, etc.
Well, the main reason I wrote a book is, at the time we were actually going to release it through EOS magazine. That's how it started. I'd written a couple of books for Craft and Vision, the black and white books, and I turned around and said to the owner of EOS magazine, you should be doing this. Why aren't you guys doing it? And so I started working on the Understanding DPP book. In the end, they didn't have the resources to just to get the thing to market, and so I ended up releasing it on my website, and they promote it, their affiliates, and they promote it through their website and newsletter, and that seems to have been the best solution. But at the time, it was originally intended to be published by them. And now EOS magazine, I don't know if you've heard of it, but you can tell from the title it's dedicated to Canon EOS users. And I'd noticed that we have a forum as well, and I noticed that there was quite a few queries from people on the forum about post-processing and using RAW in general. And it made me realize there's a lot of people that kind of new to all that sort of thing, and they're intimidated by Photoshop and they're intimidated by Lightroom because they seem complicated. I don't know where to start. The advantage of DPP is that you have it with the camera, so you don't have to buy anything. You can update it to the latest version. That's a free update, so you can always get the latest version. And it's designed to work with your camera. So like you said earlier, you've got picture styles, all the other controls within DPP emulate the controls that you can change on the camera. So it's quite easy to get to grips with. And then if you and it is a good processor as well. I mean, it's not as good as Lightroom, and I never say that it is in the book. One of the things that I do is kind of explain where DPP fits in with other RAW processors like Lightroom. So I see DPP as like an entry-level RAW processor, and then if you outgrow it, you can move on to Lightroom, which will give you more options. And so but DPP is suitable for people that are new to RAW processing and just they want to start with something that they have, something that's simple to use, something that doesn't take as long to learn, something that's not as off-putting perhaps as, you know, opening Lightroom for the first time and seeing all those controls and not really knowing where to start. And then, yeah, at some point in the future, if they outgrow DPP, they can move on to Lightroom.
Great.
Or Aperture, or, you know, whatever they may prefer to use.
Yeah, yeah. So I was having a conversation with a guy. I'd need to check the email. I think his name was Sebastian. The last time I think it was in my 5D Mark III review, I mentioned that I had tried DPP again because I wanted to. I know that Canon have put in some enhancements, things that they're actually using, like mathematical information that from the lens, from a manufacturer's perspective, to correct a lot of the chromatic aberration and the the various distortions that lenses have, all lenses have. And so I wanted to like it. And plus there was nothing else for me to process the images at first, because Lightroom didn't and still doesn't officially support the 5D Mark III files. So
right.
I installed DPP, but again, I had a horrible experience. And I found out, basically, just to backtrack a little bit more, this guy, I'm pretty sure his name was Sebastian. He emailed me. He was quite distraught about the fact that I'd again panned DPP.
yes.
And so, I mean, I know that I upset a few people with that. Mm. And in the conversation, though, I found out some of the reasons why I'm not liking it and I still can't like it. And one of them is that for some strange reason, Canon decided that on the Mac, I mean, I was a Windows user for years until last year, but on the Mac, even just to flick through the images, you can't just use the back and forward keys on the keyboard. You have to hold Command and then the arrow key to go backwards and forwards through the images. And that, to me now, it just seems so unintuitive. You have to open things in the editor before you can hit the keys to number them and rate them. Things like that, I thought, okay, I still don't like this program. But this guy had a very different view, and he actually, he shoots weddings, and he was telling me that he can get through, because the viewing of files in DPP is actually quite snappy. And so he was saying he can get through a batch of images much quicker. And he had a lot of good points. So I'm going to stop panning DPP as much as I did. But I still don't like it very much for my own workflow. But I understand that there's a place for it. And so it's interesting that you put a book out there to help people to use that.
Well, one of the things I noticed is that there isn't really any books out there to help people. There's a gap in the market. There is one book which we sell at the we have an online shop at the magazine, and we sell a book, and I was writing a couple of articles on DPP for the magazine, but the information in the book wasn't very in-depth. And it wasn't very helpful. It was kind of just like a instruction manual, really. It didn't tell people, it may tell someone how to adjust the white balance, for example, but it doesn't tell people why they should adjust the white balance and when it would be when it could be an advantage to like if you're taking a portrait, you can warm up the color temperature, that sort of thing. It didn't go into anything like that. It was just here's how you do it, but not why you would perhaps do it. And so, I'd spotted the, there was a gap in the market there.
Cool. Excellent. So now I know your third book that you've just released.
Yes.
Excellent book. I've read that. It's on a subject that's very close to my heart too. So your recent book is Understanding Exposure.
Yes. So
tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I wrote that. The kind of genesis of the idea started a couple of years ago, I think. I read a book by Michael Freeman, a very good book on exposure. And he kind of came up with, I think it was 12 different exposure scenarios or exposure situations. And the book was a little complicated, I think. It had kind of like flowcharts trying to depict the professional photographer's thought process in trying to decide what exposure settings to use in different situations. And I think what he was trying to do is kind of, you know, when you're an experienced photographer, you know, you can do this almost without thinking, perhaps not even really knowing why you're doing it. You can just do it because you've had years of practice. And I think, you know, he's trying to take his years of practice and experience and kind of break it down and analyze how he did it. And I just thought, yeah, it's overcomplicating things a bit. So I thought, well, you know, how, you know, can you look at exposure from the point of view of different exposure scenarios, but have less of them, simplify it. And, you know, and that's what I did. And I actually wrote an ebook for Craft and Vision, or sorry, not Craft and Vision, for Peach Pit last year on exposure. And using those three exposure scenarios, and it was a short ebook, so I didn't go into it in great detail. And I wanted to pitch the idea to Craft and Vision, but I couldn't think of a way of making it too, you know, different enough from the one that I'd, you know, I couldn't think of a different approach other than the one that I'd used with Peach Pit, and, you know, didn't want to do anything too similar. And then, you know, when I was thinking about ebooks for my own website, I thought, well, you know, what I should do now, I've done Understanding DPP, that's out on my website, I should just continue with this Canon idea. And you know, because that works well, you know, I can work with EOS magazine, you know, they promote it in their magazine and so on. And yeah, you know, and then suddenly I've got something that's different. You know, I can write a book about exposure specifically for Canon users, and that lets me get into, you know, the details, not just the general stuff which could apply to anybody, but to look at a specific exposure modes on Canon cameras, to look at the metering modes, to look at you know, why you would use you know, aperture priority, shutter priority, and just talk about it in terms that people who use Canon cameras will understand. Because, you know, you can go in depth, because it is just about one brand of camera. I don't have to worry about you know, whether someone who uses a Nikon or a Pentax or an Olympus is going to, you know, understand it, or, you know, what the terms that those manufacturers use for different things are, or, you know, you know, how their metering systems work, which is probably at least a little bit different from Canon's, and so on. I can just you know, make it very specific and very helpful to Canon EOS owners.
And I think, though, having read it, I think it still would be valuable to a non-Canon user, a Nikon user or Pentax or whatever. You know, I think that the book is, it's going to be much more helpful to a Canon user. But I think that there's certainly, obviously, most people understand the connection between the various systems, and I think that the Nikon you know, users would also benefit from the book. But it, I mean, on a wider scale, you know, from looking at the book as a whole, it's a very good explanation of how exposure works, and you break it down very well. So I do suggest that the listeners here you know, take a look, and I'll put links to the book in the blog post for this episode, which will be at mbp.ac/334. So if people want to go over and take a look at that, or of course they can go directly to your blog, and we'll give them some links at the end of the show as well. But yeah, I really enjoyed taking a look through the book. It's you did a good job. It's
thank you. Yes,
because I'm very much into sort of nailing the exposure in the camera myself. I actually, for many years, for probably 7 or 8 years, I shot almost exclusively in manual. So I obviously, with that experience, I understand exposure and the reasons why you'll do certain things. And but with the Canon Mark III and the high ISO capabilities that it's got, I have started to experiment more with aperture priority, which is what I shot with until 7 or 8 years ago, but also using the auto ISO, and that's something that I've had on the last couple of other cameras that I've got. But I find that auto ISO is now opening it up. You got a little bit more control in some ways, but obviously you lose control because it's something else to move automatically. But using that with aperture priority, or even with manual, You can still use it in manual. It gives you a lot of great opportunities to define how you control the exposure settings. So I'm playing around with aperture priority myself again now as well.
I mean, auto ISO is one of those things. It's developed and it's different in almost every camera that has it, but it's developed over the years, and now, you know, like you say, it's actually a useful feature.
I steered away from it until now, but a lot of that was really because of my need to totally lock down and control the exposure. But and I'll still do that. I've been professing for years. It's like the work that I do in Hokkaido, when you've got a white bird, often on a white background. Obviously, you're going to need to expose a couple of stops over.
Yes.
Overexpose for that. You can do it with exposure compensation, but the moment that bird takes off, or there's another bird flies in and it's got a dark background, almost black background,
yes,
then the bird's going to go supernova. So
yeah, it changes things. Yeah.
Right. So you have to lock it down. And doing that with exposure compensation is a pain. So generally there are times that I will always go back to manual, but I've been having a lot of fun with the 5D Mark III over this last month and playing more with aperture priority and kind of going back to how I shot before that for certain circumstances. It's good to have a number of different tools in the toolbox.
That's right. And yeah, everyone has their different way of working anyway. So yeah, like you say, in your situation, manual is kind of necessary, because when you've got that balance of light and dark tones changing all the time, that just, you know, throws your meter out every time.
Right.
And so that's difficult to compensate for. But yeah, if the lighting is very variable, say you've got the sun going out behind a cloud, something like that, then yeah, that's when exposure compensation comes in useful.
So From your latest book, Understanding Exposure, if you could give us one killer tip, if we haven't already touched on it, what would that be?
Well, it's check your histogram all the time, use RAW, and expose to the right.
That's three tips.
Three tips, but they're kind of all linked. I mean,
they are, yeah.
It sounds silly. I went out the other week taking some photos for another book I'm writing. And I was taking photos of flowers, and I forgot to check the histogram. And I didn't really realize just how, the photos were underexposed by like a stop and a half. I'm amazed that, having just written a book on exposure, I completely forgot to check the histogram, because it looked okay on the LCD screen. And it never really occurred to me that the flowers were kind of light enough to throw the meter out. I mean, I know a white or a yellow flower is going to do it, but I didn't really expect kind of like pink and red flowers to do it. And I was a little bit embarrassed, actually. So, that's where the tip comes from. You definitely, you can't take it for granted that you're getting the exposure right, even when you think you are. You just have to keep checking that histogram and make sure you're on the right path. Otherwise, you have to go back and take the photos again.
Well, you know what I find, and I totally agree, great advice there. But I found that if you have your camera set, most cameras these days have a sensor on there so that they automatically change the brightness of the LCD.
Yes.
And so without the histogram, you're actually looking at something that, although you'd expect it to be changed to the brightness according to the ambient light, which is exactly what it's doing, it can throw you as well, because it can, if it's slightly darker, make it darker so that it doesn't look too bright. If it's very bright, it'll brighten it up to compensate. But it's what it's doing is as well, without that histogram, it makes it look brighter on the LCD. So I'm totally with you there.
Yeah, especially if, like me, you have it set on the brightest setting anyway all the time.
Ah, okay. Well,
yes.
So if you're worse, overriding that, then but for sure, exposing to the right is something that, I mean, I've been singing about that for the last 8 or so years myself. So totally understand and agree with that. Great stuff. So you've got this. We mentioned earlier a slew of books on craft and vision. What topics have you covered over there?
Well, the first three books I wrote were on black and white photography.
Great books.
Yes, then the next one was called the evocative image, and that was just about taking very moody photos, different ways that you could do that. Then I wrote one called Andes, which was just photos from a few trips I made to South America where I went to the Andes quite a bit. So that was one of their print and process books. So, yeah, not a how-to book, but more kind of, the story behind the photos type of book.
Yeah.
And then the last one that I wrote was Beyond Thirds, which was about composition and moving beyond the rule of thirds and, just looking at some of the other principles of composition that, help with your photos.
Yeah, yeah. I think the only one, I forget which one it is. I think it was perhaps Beyond Thirds that I've bought and haven't read yet. I haven't had time for that one yet, but... The rest of them, I've read them all. They're excellent books, and I do intend to get to the latest one as soon as possible as well. But yeah, great books. I always enjoy them. So let's see. We've talked about a number of things. We've talked about your books on a general photography theme. Can you give us like the listeners three tips to improve their photography? In general,
Well, I kind of I break photography down. A good photo has three things: it has good lighting, it has good composition, and you have to be taking a photo of something interesting in the first place. So I would say go and take, find the most interesting thing you can to go and take a photo of. Make sure it's in the best or most suitable lighting possible, and compose it as well as you can.
Got it. Brilliant stuff. So, how about for being a writer? Obviously, that's the main part of your business. How about a couple of tips for someone that wants to become a writer, or maybe a better writer?
Yes. Well, I think it's something that's the advantage of wanting to be a writer is it's something that's actually quite easy to learn. You don't, it's not one of those things you have to go to college or university to learn, or it could help. But you can teach yourself. There's so many good, books about writing out there and websites about writing. But the thing is, you have to practice. I think you have to become an expert on what you're talking about. That helps a lot. You can practice. You can just start your own blog and get writing right away. You don't have to wait for anyone to give you permission, and you can just get going. And and it takes a while. It's like anything. It's like it took me a while to. It wasn't until I actually got the job at EOS Magazine that my writing really started to improve, to a professional level. I mean, that job was kind of, especially in the first few months, was kind of like an apprenticeship for me. I learned a lot from it. So, that was probably the single most beneficial thing that I did was getting a job with a magazine in helping me in that respect. But there's certainly so many ways that you can help yourself to learn these days. You're spoiled for choice. One website which I've been looking at a lot recently, and he has some very good articles on there. It's written by a guy called Jeff Goins. I think that's I think the URL is just jeffgoins.com, and that's Jeff JEFF, and he's a writer, and he's got some really good articles on there. So it's finding websites like that which written by writers which have lots of good articles which help you learn the craft of writing, which are very useful as well.
Got you. Great advice. When you mentioned earlier about a lot of books on writing, obviously, in addition to what you just mentioned, I've just opened iTunes to check my Audible books list for one that I listened to and really enjoyed. And it was actually Stephen King on writing. So it's the title's On Writing, a Memoir of the Craft. And I thought that was and that's more about how to really knuckle down and write a novel. Quite the same sort of things that we're talking about today, but it was a good book for me to listen to. I really enjoyed that. Lots of advice about how to schedule and make sure that you set a certain amount of time by each day or a certain number of words and things like that, and just get stuck into it. So Let's see. So where can people find you, Andrew? We're, I'll include a whole bunch of links in the blog post, but for people that are listening to the audio only, where can people find you on the big web?
Well, if they go to my website, andrewsgibson.com, then they will find everything there. I mean, there's the website itself, the blog, and then it has links to Facebook, Flickr, Google+, 500px, and Twitter, and the other sites that I use.
Great stuff. So it's been a pleasure talking with you today, Andrew, and thanks.
Yes, likewise.
Cheers then.
All right.
See you later. Bye-bye. So thanks very much for listening today. Remember that you can find me on Google Plus and Twitter, etc. All links are on the top page at martinbaileyphotography.com, so do drop by and take a look. I'll be back next week with another episode. But in the meantime, you take care and have a great week, whatever you do. Bye-bye.